Hey, I'm Tabby, and welcome to It Looks Like Courage, the podcast. I realise that I share my life with a bunch of wonderful, courageous people. Not people that necessarily have done some huge courageous act, but just in the way they live their day-to-day lives, they're courageous people. They inspire me and teach me, and I wondered if others would enjoy learning from them too. Each episode will unpack a little of their lives and hopefully help you see where you're already being courageous, but also inspire you to be even more so. On this podcast, we're joined by my great friend Rach. She is amazing, full of wisdom and courage, but I particularly wanted you guys to hear a bit about her work and how the strategies she's learned from that she's applying in lockdown. Enjoy the podcast. So today we have the wonderful Rach Bryson with us. I was trying to work out how long I've known you for, Rach.
I don't know. I think we met
11, 12. I'm thinking it may be when you were in year 11 is when I met you.
Yeah, so I think we must have met in around 2007, 2008.
Yeah. Oh, so like maybe 12, even 13 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time, over a decade for me, go back.
You're one of my oldest friends.
Isn't that a dream? So, Rach, always obviously want you on any podcast that I would ever do, but specifically wanted you on this podcast because I've been thinking for a while about your day job, and we'll talk about that more, but you like see a lot of things in the world that might scare people or that are actually quite negative things, and part of your job is working out basically problem solving, and yet it never seems to like overshadow your joy or the things that you love doing. You don't seem to come away really, really heavy. I know there are days where maybe you do, but generally you have quite a bright outlook on life and the world, even though you probably know a little bit more of the negative stuff that's happening in it. And so I kind of thought during this crazy coronavirus time, it would be super cool to hear some of your like strategies and some of the things that you've learned from your work, but like putting that in place of this virus, because I think the people I'm speaking to at the moment, there's just so much fear and so much uncertainty and that like loss of control. For some people, they're fine, it's not really bothering them. Some people it's occasional, and some people it's like really full on. Or just even like feeling unsettled when you read a news article or something comes up on social media, and it's just like feeding that sense of like fear and panic, I think. And so I thought it'd be really, really helpful to hear from you. But before we do that, I thought I'd ask you about your lockdown experience so far. Tell me what fun you've had being locked down, first of all.
I have had quite a lot of fun being locked down. I think one of the joys has been slowing down life and being a little bit more present. So I love exercise. I love fun games. Before we had official lockdown, so, and it was kind of like you could still go outside with your pals. I love playing cricket in the garden or in a park, playing spike ball. When it got slightly more strict on the rules, my housemates and I would have loads of fun at snippets of the day, just having a bit of a dance in the kitchen just to keep morale high, cooking together, having meals, and that kind of thing. I just think I've loved the time to do that, do a bit more painting. Recently become one of those very annoying people that has got really into cycling. Now I realize they are frustrating because I've seen many of my friends do it, but unashamedly taking it on as a big hobby at the moment, which is good fun.
Do you have the whole lycra suit? How do you feel about that?
Embarrassingly, tonight I googled it. I don't have the lycra suit, but apparently it makes you go so much quicker, and it's my birthday coming up quite soon, and mum and dad were kindly saying that I could potentially even have an early birthday present to improve isolation with a new set of lycra.
What colour lycra are you going to go for?
Well, this is the current debate. You've literally hit the conversation of the day. So in dad's mind, the brighter the better, so you can actually be seen on the roads. And I'm so up for the bright colours, but I think it's got to be tasteful.
Also, are you thinking a little bit about what's flattering? Because as stunning as you are, Lycra is, you know, there's nowhere to hide in Lycra, is there?
It's awful. I in my day-to-day life for the last few years, I have cycled to work. And so okay. I've gone in my running kit on my bike, which I think is a little bit more forgiving. But the cycling Lycra is just embarrassing, and it really isn't flattering at all. But I think once you've committed to it, you're kind of in the bracket of people that it's acceptable. Do you know, you're like, oh, they're one of them, and I think I'm just going to become one of them.
I think it's important to be one of them, but in appropriate places. I find it really unsettling, you know, when someone's in their like full Lycra suit in the middle of Tesco's, and I'm like, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see that when I'm buying my sweet corn or something.
That's actually really useful to know. I probably should just set out parameters for myself going into this Lycra world, being like, okay, Rach, rule number one, don't go into Tesco and do your weekly shop in Lycra. Yeah. But and be seen in the countryside wearing your Lycra, bright colours, rocking it.
I think that's appropriate. So you're going for bright colours pretty much. That's the way forward?
I think I have to for safety. Bright but tasteful. So I'll let you know when I've actually bought it, what it's like.
Just send a little picture and I could put it up on the Looks Like Courage Instagram if you wanted.
I think that might be slightly embarrassing, but probably will do this.
Let people know what you've chosen. So what's been hard for you in lockdown? What have you not enjoyed, aside from the obvious things?
I really miss my friends. I think normally in life build in a lifestyle that has loads of different rhythms, different environments, different people. And I do that because I love the change from one thing to the next, and adventure and fun and giggles. And I think having more of a similar rhythm in life means it can be more monotonous. That doesn't mean it has to be, but I found it a challenge making the similar rhythm fun. I definitely have found ways to do it, and I'm really grateful for that. But I do miss gathering with pals and being in bigger groups. I this is a random one I didn't expect that I would miss, but I really miss like dancing. I didn't really appreciate how much it's just so fun with a bunch of friends having some music on, whether it's like, I don't know,
at the club.
Into clubs, definitely don't go clubbing, but I just really miss that. So that's why we've reenacted it in our kitchen, to have a good boogie around the kitchen.
We're doing dance parties too with the girls. Regular dance parties in our house.
I bet they love that. Is that to Frozen?
No, Phoebe's has discovered this song that's called All Through History, and she loves it. So yeah, it's that on repeat over and over again. But she doesn't have Frozen. That's also in the mix. But yeah, last few days pretty much just been All Through History, which is great. So I was thinking earlier, I so fancy an amazing pizza. There's this really great place in Bristol called Pizza Workshop, which we went to recently, and it was so lush. And I was thinking, when this lockdown is over, that I'm going to head there for pizza. What are you going to do when lockdown is over?
Well, we as a street, we've actually planned, when lockdown started, in the last day, I snuck in loads of letters to everyone's house along our street saying, like, let's create a WhatsApp group. And I said, if you want to join it, send me a message and we can, you know, create this group. And the whole of our street have joined it, and there's well over 100 people on it now. And my message to them was like, once this is over, let's have a street barbecue. And they were all excited about it, but that has escalated to planning a whole street party. And there's been videos of our actual street from like 2013 where there's just massive parties and like DJ sets, like summer barbecues. And apparently our street has a bit of a history of being extremely communal and friendly, but at the moment we're not friends except for our WhatsApp group. So we will definitely do that as soon as we can, just open up the street, open up our home, get the locals around and actually meet these people face to face, which I'm really excited for.
They'll be dancing in the street then, by the sounds of it.
Yes, winning on every count.
That is so fun. I actually thought the other day we should do a street party in our street, but I'm not really sure that everyone will go for that, to be honest. So we'll see. Not even many people turn up to plan during the NHS thing, so I was a bit shocked about how few people are clapping. But so that kind of gives me a temperature reading of potentially the idea of a street party, but we shall see.
if you do the NHS clap, then slowly start conversations across the hedge, you might end up having a street party before you know it.
True. I mean, me and my next door neighbour, I reckon, might have a party. But beyond that, I'm not sure. But I, you know, I'll keep trying. Persistence is the way to go, right?
Yeah, totally.
So, Rach, a little bit about you. You lived in Kenya quite a long time, didn't you?
So we did. We lived there for 6 years as a family and lived in Tanzania for two before that. So spent most of my childhood, kind of like my memorable childhood, was in East Africa, which was glorious. Mum and dad are teachers. Dad was born there. So it's really, for him, it's home. And for us, it's one of the homes, I guess, that we have. I think we're quite flexible about location, but it was an incredible childhood in many ways. Came back to the UK, which is when I met you, 2007-2008, and then finished off my school in the UK and headed off to uni in Edinburgh.
Now, why did you choose to study what you studied? Tell us what you studied and then talk me through why you studied those things.
So I studied Arabic and French. I struggled quite a lot deciding what to study in school.
I remember
many conversations with you being a bit stuck on what was best. And I think the idea of doing Arabic and French felt quite right. Arabic was new. I didn't know anything before university. And French, I loved. I really enjoyed the way that languages like opened up doors to different cultures and taught you a lot about what's going on in the world. But also were challenging. And so I went for Arabic and French, partially because it was a challenge. I was excited for it. The other part would probably be because it felt right. I think Arabic, it was immensely challenging and still is immensely challenging. I don't think that'll ever stop. But the idea of doing it did excite me. And it is a kind of logical language, but also really creative and musical and kind of fed into the stuff that I love. So did that in uni up in Edinburgh, had a year abroad in Morocco, a little bit in Tunisia and then France, and just began to fall in love with the language. And it kind of opened up my understanding of the Middle East, but also North Africa. And I think then having the East African childhood and then the kind of Middle Eastern North African education, it just opened up my mind a lot to what is going on in the world.
Which then presumably led you into the kind of field that you work in.
Yeah, so it led me, I think, sadly, through studying Arabic, especially Arabic, it opened up quite a profound understanding of what's going on in terms of conflict worldwide, because when I was in uni, ISIS had just started, and so a lot of our translations and understanding of kind of Syria, Iraq was looking at what was happening politically and practically in these countries. And so we would study day in, day out the kind of current affairs of the Middle East, and we once we graduated, a lot of the doors in terms of career path led to conflict resolution or counterterrorism, which is basically where I sit now. So I work in that kind of a field, which is looking at global conflict. How do we bring peace? How do we work in countries that are torn apart by war, whether it be counterterrorism or disinformation, fake news, propaganda, the kind of stuff that we're seeing more and more of in the news at the moment? And how do we bring peace? So almost on the one hand, it's really sad that Arabic naturally led into that course, but also at the same time, I'm so grateful, because I wouldn't say my interest in the field started at university. I'd say it probably harks back to, I would say, when I was 10 years old. We were in Rwanda on a family holiday on the 10th anniversary of the genocide that happened in Rwanda, and Dad is extremely passionate about Africa and the conflicts that have happened there, and how do we work in Africa to, and the Middle East in particular, to bring peace. And so from a child age, he really exposed us to that, and kind of tragedy was sadly all around in terms of extreme poverty and poor governance and just injustice was really visible from a young age, and particularly 10 years old when I went to Rwanda and saw the impact of the genocide there. It shaped me probably more than I'm able to articulate. And so from that age onward, as a teenager, I'd read two sorts of books. One would be about faith and God and that kind of a topic, and the other side would be Rwandan genocide. And I read so much about it and just grew a big heart for how do we work in these kind of places. So kind of as life grew and as I grew up and then did Arabic, it fed quite naturally into the career that I'm currently in.
So you're 9 to 5, I imagine it's really varied. What are the sorts of conversations or sorts of situations that you find yourself involved with across the world?
So they're actually really varied. I work for a company that runs government-funded projects in countries affected by conflict. So my job in particular is to design these projects, which means that I can look from, I'll give you a few tangible examples. It could be in Somalia, how do we work in areas that have just been recovered from Al-Shabaab, so the local terrorist group there. Once yeah. the military pushes them out of a village, we would work in those areas and meet with the people on the ground and say, what are your needs? How can we help you build a more constructive society than you currently have? How can we help you? Mm-hmm. So the next day we can be looking at Syria and Iraq. We can say, okay, for the last few years, ISIS has been really present there. What messaging can we, how can we inspire locals to promote more of a peaceful message in their own countries and work towards peace? Or another day, it could be, okay, so in Ukraine, there is a lot of fake news being spread around the European Union, in particular in the destructive messages that of the West and kind of the Western democracy. How do we understand what's going on and then work with locals to kind of give more of an equal picture? So it can really vary from country to country and topic to topic.
And I guess like what you're seeing presumably is like the multiple layers and stuff that basically impact a nation, whatever kind of nation. Like you were saying, then there's like on the ground thing, there's fake news, there's government level, it's like all these different things are impacting a yeah. person and a situation. And then thinking about you, like reading about your Rwandan genocide books, and as a child probably feeling quite hopeful about things changing and hope and stuff. And I really remember my mum got me these books about like some favelas and prostitution in Brazil. I think I was like 11, so I don't quite know why she got them for me then, but anyway. And there was like this amazing kind of dance school that went in and like really helped change things. And it was that kind of like, that's a kind of line I think kids often get fed, is like all of this can be solved, you know, which is amazing. But presumably the more involved you get, the more complicated you realize situations are. And how do you navigate that sense of like desperately wanting things to get better and basically that injustice would just go and there would be justice for everyone and equal opportunities, etc., but knowing how complex it is, how do you carry that?
I don't think it's easy, and I think my approach has changed and probably will continue to change over my lifetime. I think talking about your book when you were around 11, I remember clearly in university we had to write an essay on military interventions. Why does a country like the UK or the US conduct a military intervention? And my understanding was so naive. I was like, oh, it's entirely, you know, for the good, and like these things are purely to help people. And I had a Syrian teacher who was like, it's so much more complex than that, Rach. You've really got to understand the different levels of what's going on. And I was like, but everyone has good intentions. We all want to save this world and make it a better place. And I came from a heart and a childhood of like, let's do all that we can to fix this world, to then realizing actually how deeply broken it is and how much politics and relationships between countries and selfish desires, humanity, injustice is sewn into a really messed situation globally. And almost the realization of that really broke my heart as a young adult, of seeing not only is there complete injustice in specific contexts, whether they're torn apart by war or have been, there's been famine or, you know, you name it, that in and of itself is too much to process. But then you add on top of that the international dynamics that can be so unfair and selfish in many ways. I found it a heartbreaking thing to see in more depth, kind of as I stepped into adulthood. And seeing that is not easy, and working in the field is definitely not easy at all. And I have got some mechanisms in place, I guess you could call it that, to stay hopeful. And I would say there are probably a few. I think I'm obviously passionate about what's going on in the world, and so I love reading the news and I love being informed on the international scene. But I am very careful about rationalizing that and keeping it to maximum twice a day, often once, because we can get overwhelmed with current affairs. It's on a rolling clock every minute and it's too much. So I really try to reduce that. I think all things in moderation is such an, it's an old phrase, but it's really useful. So we can dive into looking at what's going on in the world, but make sure it's reduced. Make sure life is mixed up. As I mentioned, what I miss of normal life is the kind of chop and change, different scenes, lots of different things going on. And for me to stay hopeful, I've got to ensure I switch off from the sadness of what's going on in the world at certain points of the day, whether that's leaving the office, doing some exercise, having fun, having a good giggle, eating well, or if it's just being like, Rach, you have to stop thinking about this because you've done your part. But I think within the whole of that, the really key thing is there's only so much that each of us can take on in our day-to-day lives. We can't carry all of the world's burdens ourselves, but we can do our part in it, whether that's praying a lot, whether that's actually having a career that is positioned to trying to make a difference. If it's working or supporting or volunteering in an organization that can help out on the bigger scene, there's kind of, there's many different things that we can do. And I think it's actually important that we're engaged, but also aware that we cannot solve all of these problems. And so we can play our own part in these stories.
Yeah, that's so good. Do you feel like actually having a purpose in it, like, you know, this is what I'm doing, so like for you it is like my 9-to-5 is this, but also you've used, you know, your Arabic, haven't you, to help some families that are refugees settling into the UK, and it's like you're using an ability or a gift that you've got to further somebody else's experience in life, to help remove some of the injustice of having to flee your own country and then come to a place that you don't know the language, you don't know how the education system works, the healthcare system, etc. Is that helpful that you've been able to like give out or find purpose in amidst the overwhelming nature of bad news?
I do think that's a huge element. I would say I'm really grateful that my career is one that I'm passionate about. And so on kind of a 9-to-5, I'm in a place where I'm able to work in an area that I care about. But also I'm aware that so many people aren't in that position, and it's actually on the one hand privileged and on the other hand can be immensely overwhelming. And I have some friends who are like, I'm so glad I don't work in the field that I'm passionate about, because I don't think I could deal with it. I don't think I could carry it. And that is totally fair. But the beauty of actually having opportunities in life, whether it be, as you say, working with a refugee family in your, like, one evening a week, just to be like, what have I got in my capacity? What's in my toolbox, as it were, that I can use and draw on in this world that is so broken and really heartbreaking, to try and do my part to bring joy to someone's life and try and heal the mess that we're in. I know full well that I cannot solve every situation going. If I ever thought I could, it would be outrageous. And so almost being like, okay, Rach, you deal with this, you've done that, And now you just love wherever you go, and you actually make a really intentional decision to love, but also have clear boundaries of you've done your part. Now you need to switch off from these issues that can be really overwhelming.
And so when we're thinking about this season that we're all in, the coronavirus time, which we're in the middle of, we really don't know how long the lockdown measures will last, but even the virus itself, like, again, there's so much news about, well, what if it comes back in November? Does everything lock down again then? And, you know, all those things, it's like swimming around our minds, conversations. Have you related any of what you've learned from existing within the extremes, I guess, of your job?
Yeah.
To now?
I have, actually, and I think I'd even say I found I've been more overwhelmed in the time of corona than I expected. Almost, it's quite easy when I'm looking at international problems to feel distant from them. Yeah. And there is such immense injustice, which I feel to the core of me, but I'm not experiencing it. So I can almost have that distance between myself and Somalia and look at the country and say, this should happen. Let's build a program that has an impact.
Yeah.
But realistically, it doesn't affect me personally, except for the injustice I feel. Whereas yeah. I would say COVID, I've personally been affected in a way that my life has been, the freedoms have been curtailed. There is immense suffering. There is a lot more exposure to death, insecurity, uncertainty, anxiety is flying through the roof all around us. And we don't know what tomorrow holds. For the first time in years, we can't make plans. Almost a lifetime, we can't. And so I've actually probably been more exposed to the concerns around that and the heightened anxiety and overwhelmed feelings on a personal level than I have for a while. But I have found that the transferable skills of sort of how do I deal with the global scene has been able to shimmy across, as it were, into the corona issue that we're facing. Now, simply, we cannot let it overwhelm us. We can engage with it. It's important to stay up to date. It's important to know what the new government regulations are. But we then have to take a step back. And a lot of friends have said, I refuse to watch the news after 6 p.m. because I need to have time to cool down before I go to bed. Otherwise, I'm riddled with worry at bedtime. I need to not be concerned about provision when I know that I've got stuff in the house. And I need to just decide, Rach, you've got enough food to last you this long. Don't even begin to get riddled with fear about it. Or, you know, there's kind of like, how do we shut our thought life off and say, it is okay, do not be overwhelmed.
Yeah.
As well as sewing in the joys. So just like I said, all in moderation, there's got to be a kind of, how do you sew in stuff that brings you joy? How do you lift your eyes above the circumstance you're in?
Yeah.
And look up. And I, for myself, a lot of that is to do with my faith as well. I think having faith and trusting in a God that is above what's going on, in terms of he is with us in it. Mm-hmm. And yet his perspective is far greater than we could ever imagine. For me, that brings peace when I have no understanding of what's going on at the moment.
That's good. It's really interesting. I'm finding like everyone now is like virtually having to connect, aren't they? So you, like the people who are working, all their meetings are done virtually, just friendships are all virtual. And yet all of like the mental health and like well-being advice is like, get off your phone. Like don't have the screen going on. Don't read the news constantly. Like give your brain some space, you know, all that stuff is like actually what a lot of professionals would say is that too much screen time, too much scrolling is actually really unhealthy for us and for our anxiety levels and everything else. And yet at the same time, people are suddenly like living on their own or away from their community and really needing it. And like finding that balance of being connected and then also just finding peace in the situation that you're in, whether that's with family or a house share or whatever it might be, feels a really important balance to find at this time. Because I think, yeah, too much news, but even too much like social media of like what everybody else is up to during lockdown probably isn't actually that helpful.
It isn't. I find it often. I actually ask friends, I'm like, how are you doing with this time? Because how you, like, what can you teach me on how to live this well? It's so new for us all. It's often, before this time, it was advised, don't be on your phone, it causes anxiety. And now you're like, be on your phone, make contact with your friends. And and the tension, as you say, between that is, it either way, it ends up being immensely overwhelming. And almost boundaries are so key over this, aren't they, of saying, I'm going to turn my phone off at this time every night, and I'm going to make sure it stays off until several hours after I wake up, so that I can actually have space where I'm not overwhelmed with current affairs, which can wait, and contact, which can wait. Because often you think, as soon as I wake up, I need to know. But you could have woken up an hour later and nothing would have gone on in that time, you know. So ensuring that there's the boundaries in your day-to-day life that provides space for you to create and to think and to dream, process, and not be bombarded with new information every minute is so key.
And to find that rest place, which is like, if you're healthy at the moment, to actually have some time where you're not required to do anything or be anywhere, or just to be and to rest. It's got to be healthy for us all to learn to switch off a bit, which is something that none of us really do, and we're kind of forced into it. But our phones are almost taking the place of that, so we're not resting because we're like constantly in touch. But actually, it's quite like it's a really important thing, I think, for us to learn to disconnect.
It is, well. And I think when we look back on this time, I not for one second wish Corona were around, nor there was a heightened death or anxiety, the economy's falling apart. But I think there's elements of it that we will look back on and grieve the loss of. And I think we have an opportunity in this time to actually ask some of the bigger questions, take space to learn about who we are when the noise of life has quietened and we're not surrounded by so many distractions, a busy life, travel, or friends, and actually we are quietened in ourselves and we can listen to what our kind of soul surface is. And if we courageously dive into those questions, into those settings, I think we will surface from this time in a much stronger and healthier place individually, but also as a society. But it takes real courage, because I think those questions can be hugely overwhelming. Again, they can be really quite scary to engage with what's actually going on inside of us.
Yeah. So just thinking about that, I wanted to ask you about how would you say to like build up a resilience towards the overwhelming nature of bad news, but also like all the current projections? You know, like sometimes you read something and it's like an economist from this place and they're predicting this big crash and all of these kind of really negative and awful things happening, and some of them are happening now, like people are losing their jobs. You know, we know that's true, but you're like, how extreme is this going to be? Or, you know, you read something else and you're like, is that even credible news? I don't know, but it's put this idea in my head now that X is going to happen. And then sometimes you read really positive things, like people are going to be much more socially aware, and maybe it's a time for people to make sure that everybody's got better access to all these other things that they haven't had and all that stuff. There's like positives and negatives, but how do we like build up a resilience towards the nature of how overwhelming the news is, let alone the bad news, but not lose our compassion? So I think for some people, like finding out about other people stockpiling has sent them to the supermarket to like grab everything that they possibly can and store it, because just in case. But then you thought, there's no compassion in that. Like, I understand it. But then you think, what about those people that cannot afford to stockpile? And the food banks are emptier now because people are just hoarding. And it's like, that feels to me like a bit of a lack of compassion for the people we're living amongst, you know? But I can completely understand that you hear something or read something or are bombarded over and over with this sense of like the supermarkets are going to be empty. And so your natural instinct is to like hoard and hold, but that actually doesn't feel like resilience. That just feels like fear.
Yeah, it's caused such an interesting kick up in society, hasn't it, in terms of what has surfaced within different people, myself included. And I've actually been really struck how I've responded in negative ways that I never would have thought I had in me. And yet I see myself reacting in ways I'm like, Rach, that's so not okay. Look at the bigger picture. And actually the vulnerable people who are seriously struggling and can't afford to do an entire week's shop.
Yeah.
you've just taken all of the stuff that they need today. And I think I've been trying to learn, but I don't know how. But I think we need to have grace for one another in our responses. And living in a house of six, we are aware that actually one another has so many different ways and we can respond moment to moment, let alone day to day, and we can't predict it, which is difficult on a personal level. When I react in ways I don't expect, I'm wobbled. And then when other people see me, A, react differently, and B, get wobbled, they're wobbled, let alone their own personal wobbles. And so it can kind of create a really unstable and unenjoyable environment if we're not careful.
Yeah.
But I found a key to that is having grace for yourself and grace for one another. And there is enough grace to go around. We have grace and we can walk in it new every single day. And I think that is something that is vital.
Yeah.
But how do we get that grace is the question. And I think there are several things I found useful. I think every day having some time of peace and quiet and reflection and looking at the bigger picture of what is going on in the sense of whether that's on a faith side. Like for me, as I've mentioned, I get strength in that. I'm like, God, I look to you as a loving father and provider who will never leave us and never forsake us. Would you give me your perspective over this issue and help me love the best that I can? Or if it's for people who don't necessarily have faith, look at the joys that we have, look at the stuff that brings you to life and grow a heart that is grateful and able to say in the face of the suffering that we're in, hey, you know what, I'm grateful for X, Y, and Z. It could be simply the fact that my friend is well, the fact that I can ring my neighbor and check in. It could be thank you, Lord, or thank you that I have food for today. You know, we can grow our gratitude. And what it does is it shifts our perspective from one of fear and being overwhelmed to actually freedom. It brings a real sense of freedom as we look at the problems that we're facing. But I would say also just one more thing. I'd say actually we are so much more resilient than we ever think. And we can often think we are unable to deal with the next challenge around the corner because we feel quite worn out. But actually, I say this joke quite regularly, but I mean it wholeheartedly, where I say, we've got 100% success rate on every single day we've ever lived thus far. And like every single problem that we've ever faced, we're still standing. And I joke about it and people laugh at me a lot over it. But I think there is something of saying, we are so much stronger and so much more resilient than we could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. Let's not let fear rule our decisions. And how can we ensure that we do that? We love, we're grateful, we choose joy, we look to the bigger picture, and we encourage one another on this walk that we're on.
That is so good. Thanks, pal. I just thought I'd give you a little opportunity to plug your podcast because, as always, I'm inspiring you, and now you decided to copy me and host your own podcast. So tell us about it. And tell us where we can listen to it if people have, which they will, loved hearing from you. They can listen to you even more.
Oh, Tabs, you ledge. I have actually been so inspired by you and definitely done a podcast off the back of it. I started a podcast in isolation, which I realise has been slammed heavily on Instagram by all the memes saying everybody's going to start a podcast and we have. But I'm actually really excited about it. It's called... Revival Nuggets. For a second I almost forgot the title, which is awful, but
you think about chicken nuggets a little bit when you say it.
Yeah, we do think about chicken nuggets every time, and then it makes me quite hungry when we're recording it. But it's talking about how do we bring life in this life at the moment that can feel slightly mundane. And we talk about all things from God to dating in Corona times to facing suffering, how do we do that courageously, to how do we tell stories that bring hope. And it's kind of a, let's just rally the troops, let's get everyone together and talk about the issues that we're facing in a lighthearted but also inspiring way. So definitely have a listen.
So just because we've done this in our conversations, you've mentioned the dating one, and I am trying to persuade you to do some online dating, and I think that you should do a few like delivery dates and tell us about them. Why is that not going to make the podcast?
I should totally get that in. I maybe should. I mean, I think like if I have been joking with friends that there's a couple friends I know who have done
matchmake.
Yeah, they've done that in this time. So they basically ended up saying, I'll order you a Deliveroo and I'll order myself the same food. And I know a guy who's like dressed up, looking lovely with a glass of wine, and like the girl looks gorgeous too. And they're just kind of approaching the whole dating scene almost in an even more chilled way at the moment, which I love, because I think we've often said this to each other, but it can get quite intense and the fun can be whipped out of the whole dating scene quite quickly. So people are approaching it with more of a lighthearted manner. So it's
you should have a few dates and then report back.
Maybe I should. Maybe the next pod looks like courage should be Rach's dating life. She's stepped out of the boat.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a bit of courage, doesn't it, to date sometimes?
It does.
Say yes to the bloke. Anyway, I'm looking forward to hearing that podcast. Rach, thank you so much for being with us. You're amazing, and I've loved having you.
Thanks, Tabs.